So now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for the day, Professor Ray Madoff, who's professor of law at Boston College Law School, where she teaches trusts and estates, estate and gift tax, estate planning, and a seminar now famous on immortality in the law. She's the author of Immortality in the Law, The Rising Power of the American Dead, which we'll have a copy you can look at while you're here, published in the spring from Yale University Press, and we'll hear much more about that today. The book's been widely discussed since its publication this spring. Professor Madoff is also the lead author of The Practical Guide to Estate Planning. And prior to teaching, she was a practicing attorney for 10 years in Boston and New York. Her undergraduate work was from Brown, and her law degree is NYU. So thanks so much for being here. She'll have 15 or 20 minutes to talk, and the rest will be given over to you.
I'm going
to
talk fast.
thanks and welcome.
Thank you. I almost have no time for pleasantries, but I can't resist because the Boise Center is just such a great place to be, and it's such a pleasure for me to be here. I've come a number of times for lunches, and every time I have, I've been amazed not just by how interesting it is at the time and how good the food is and how nice the company, but also the ideas that are presented have really stuck with me afterwards, and I find myself going back to them. So it's been great. And also, of course, anything involving Alan Wolfe is superb and always interesting. And
my friend.
And oh, now I'm disappointed. Though, you know, lunch is always tremendously interesting, his talks are interesting, and but the good thing about Alan is you don't have to actually travel to the main campus, for those of us in law school who have trouble parking and things like that, in order to see him. We simply need to, you know, open the New York Times or turn on my radio, and he's invariably there. So that's lucky for all of us. So my topic today is about how the law treats the interests of the dead, or at least those wishes as they are expressed by the pre-dead, more commonly known as the living. And as I said, this is the research that has resulted in this book. And you might be interested about, you know, what would get a seemingly, you know, normal-looking person into a topic like this. And certainly you wouldn't feel any better if you saw my bookcase in my office, which is not filled with, like, Alan and Eric's with, like, justice and this and that, but, like, you know, The Grim Reader, Life After Death, The Death of Death, you know, all, you know, seemingly fairly dark stuff. But what happened is that I teach at the law school, and I teach in the areas of trusts and estates, and estate and gift tax, and estate planning. And for those of you who aren't lawyers or haven't studied this, trusts and estates is the law about, you know, giving your property at death, and sometimes during life. But the big principle that dominates it is this idea of freedom of testation, that Americans have the ability to control their property at death. And we take this ability to control property at death very, very seriously. It's a big part of our culture. It's a big part of our literature, and it's something that we value a lot. But I began to think about, like, well, why do we value it so much? Why do we care so strongly about controlling what happens after we're dead? After all, we're going to be dead, and presumably, you know, we'll be beyond harm and benefit, as the law sometimes says about other areas. But yet it's this thing that we feel really, you know, we feel strongly about. And I decided that perhaps what's going on here is that the ability to control property after death affords us this little bit of immortality. It's like a consolation prize. You know, you might be gone, but don't worry. Your wishes are still going to be respected with respect to your property when you're gone. And I think that might be, you know, at least some explanation for the reason people care about controlling property at death and the reason people are so threatened, or the effectiveness of that whole death tax rhetoric, because the whole death tax rhetoric is, it basically gets to this idea that, you know, you're taking somebody at their most vulnerable time, you know, they're dead, and you're taking property from them. It feels unfair. It feels that you're hitting them when they're down in this way. So, but of course, if you think about this idea of giving rights to debts, you can understand why people want it. But you also have to think about what costs we get when you impose. And it's a little bit hard to see in areas where we give rights to the dead because it just feels very natural to us. And so we think, well, whatever costs they are, they can't be too great. But if you think about areas where we don't give rights to the dead, it sort of helps us think a little bit more creatively, perhaps, about this issue. So I was thinking about voting rights, right? Let's say you have somebody very committed to a particular party, and you can fill in your favorite one here, or least favorite. Well, no matter how committed a person was to their party during life, we would look askance if they said, look, I'm going to leave this stack of ballots, and I want you to just submit them, you know, every 4 years, or maybe we'll do them for other elections, too. You know, they're here, just you know how I want to vote. And the reason is twofold. I think one is we think, well, you know, you can't really make a very good decision. You can't make a very informed decision if you don't know what the world is like when you're, you know, sort of putting your wishes out there. And second of all, even if you could make a good decision, who really cares what you think? Because after all, you're dead. And so, you know, why should we care? And yet, when it comes to property, we have this whole other approach. So it was sort of an interesting conundrum to me about why something can feel so natural and right in some area and so crazy on the other area and what's going on. And that's sort of all what prompted this inquiry into the law of the dead. How does the law treat interests of the dead? What I thought I was going to find was that the law was kind of all over the place and didn't really have much rhyme or reason. And so I was going to, my original project was to do this interdisciplinary study with the chapter one was going to be like 25 pages of the law of the dead. And then chapter two was going to be looking at philosophy, can the dead be harmed? And I had actually, that was the chapter that I wrote for my book proposal. And then sociology, and then psychology, what is it, you know, what psychological needs does it fulfill to respect wishes of the dead? And then sociology, doesn't that sound like an interesting book? Okay, anyway, that was the idea. I didn't know whether or not I had to include religion, which would have really entitled me to be here. In any event, I sat down to write that book, and I started with the law after I'd written the philosophy chapter. I'd gotten a contract based on that really big, interesting book. And I sat down to write the law, and I thought I was going to write about, and I was going to write the body. And that was going to be, in my mind, like three paragraphs. And I was going to say, well, you can leave instructions about your body, but they're not really enforceable. That's something like that. And then I was going to expand it, so it would be three paragraphs, because two sentences might be a little short. So I went to look for some sites, and I looked at some really embarrassing places, sort of like the Encyclopedia Britannica of the Law. I looked at ALR and other sources. And I came across this phrase, corpus nullius in bonis. The body belongs to no one. And I thought, wow, that's kind of interesting, because you sort of think, like, if you own anything, you know, you think pretty much it's got to be the body in which you inhabit and live your life. I mean, that sort of feels like it's mine. But the law doesn't take that approach. It actually says that when you're dead, the body belongs to no one. And based on this, the law has unfolded in all of these really interesting ways. So that, for example, when there was grave robbery going on, which I learned was needed for anatomical studies for the growth of medical schools, and which was a big, what's that?
And Frankenstein.
And Frankenstein. The several needs of bodies. When you had that, it was very difficult to figure out what the crime was when people were stealing bodies because the body belonged to no one. There was no property interest in the body, and so that was a whole challenge in and of itself. In any event, this study of corpus nullius in bonis took me through this wild ride, as I mentioned, about about grave robbery and organ transplants and posthumous procreation and the fact that you can exhume sperm from dead men and cryonics and can you just store a body in a freezer and all of this stuff. And you know, it was 67 pages later that I finally emerged. At one point, I was really stuck with the whole medical stories about medical students if they're talking about how they were involved in grave robbery. And my husband said to me, okay, you've got to move on now. Because I've come home filled with these very exciting stories. So in any event, I realized that the subject actually was really interesting, and there was a lot more there than I thought. And basically, as I turned to each area, whether it was the body, or then I turned to controlling property, and then I turned to committing property to charitable and other purposes, and finally to reputation. In each area, I found this amazing array of interesting stories that I just couldn't believe how interesting they were and how much they revealed, really, is what I couldn't, about who we are. Because what I did in terms of trying to understand the rules was I did some comparative work. It's sort of not really great, exhaustive comparative work, but the kind of, oh, look, here, I'm able to get the law of Italy because we had an Italian judge visiting. Well, this is a really interesting comparative, you know, that type of comparative work. But what I found by doing comparative work and by looking over time, how has our law changed over time, was a number of really interesting things. The first is that although death itself might be universal, the treatment of the interests of the dead is anything but. And in fact, each country has its own approach to these rules about the interests of the dead, and not surprisingly, the United States takes its own sort of distinctly American approach to the law of the dead. So just just to touch on a couple, it's basically where we have this value of freedom of testation, we actually stand alone, you know, way over on a line, if you set a line up, in terms of the ability to control property at death. Most of the world operates under a system where up to 80% of your property has to go to your family. In our country, you can disinherit anyone. You can even disinherit your minor children if the children would result in being wards of the state. No problem. It's your property. Freedom of testation is above the obligation to support your children, even though your obligation to support your children during life, as we say, is quite serious. So that was one thing I found. Another really interesting comparison came about in terms of libel and things you can say about the dead in the United States. Anything goes when it comes to the dead. The dead have absolutely no interest at all. And if I had time, I'd tell you the unbelievable case that I read. You'll have to throw me that softball if you want to hear it. Throughout most of Western Europe, in fact, that's not the case. And there's great protection of reputational interests of the dead. And James Whitman has done some very interesting work about differing notions of privacy, how Americans are interested in liberty and Western Europe is interested in dignity, and I think that sort of plays out in these privacy rights where dignity and so, for example, when Saddam Hussein was executed, TV stations here could cover it however they wanted, but throughout Western Europe, they were said, you better be careful how you cover this because you can be thrown in jail if you violate the dignity of him by publicizing this thing. The other thing that I saw is that by looking at American law over time, I saw this tremendous trend that I didn't know had existed, which is that we have been granting more and more rights to the dead. That, in fact, if you look at what the country was like throughout the 19th century and today, it's in terms of the rights of the dead, the changes have been enormous. So, for example, in terms of controlling property for private, you know, the trust is the device that we have where you control, put on instructions about property. Well, for almost all of our country's history, there was very strict time limits over which you could do it. It was about 90 years. It was enforced through the rule against perpetuities. Well, now states have been repealing the rule against perpetuity. Some say you can do it for 350 years. Some say 1,000 years. But a whole bunch of others say, no, don't tie people down that way. Let them do it forever. Don't limit them to just 1,000 years. That's been one big area of change. Copyright has been another big area of change. There you have the original term of copyright was 14 years with one 14-year renewal, and then the work was to be available to the public at large. And Jefferson was very interested in that not going after the person's death. And he, in fact, consulted actuarial tables to sort of see what would be a good time period to have where it would, you know, roughly end with death. Well, that term has been extended and extended over time, and now it lasts until 70 years after a person's death. And so what that means is that something created today is not going to be available until sometime in the mid-2100s. That's when the public will be able to use it. We've seen similar expansions in other areas as well. So we've had this, as I say, the rising power of the American debt. And in my last 1 minute, I want to talk about why I think this has occurred. I think that in part it's been allowed to occur because of the stealth nature. You don't really, you know, who even knows about this thing? I teach in the area, I've taught in it for 17 years, and I didn't really notice it myself till I, you know, did this peculiar study. But the stealth nature of the changes has occurred because it's largely occurred on a state-by-state basis. You know, who's really paying attention to how Alaska's changing its law, or Delaware, with the expansion of the right of publicity, Indiana and Tennessee have been driving forces. So we don't really notice because it's been occurring on a state-by-state basis, and it's been occurring kind of incrementally. The other thing is, I think, that the United States is a particularly ahistorical country. I think that our history is much shorter than other countries, and in part because the founders of this country were so concerned about issues of dead hand control, they put a lot of rules in place that made it such that we don't suffer dead hand control today. So because of this idea that we had the rule against perpetuities, we had all these different rules in place that limited the ability of the dead to impose things for a long time going into the future. And so we don't really understand the cost of it. So when we think about giving rights to the dead, we think, sure, well, I mean, don't be stingy. Give them to the dead. They earned it. Let's be nice. But we don't realize the countervailing cost the way I think that we would more readily if we had a longer history or if we lived in a country where the dead had been imposing their wishes, you know, in a stronger way. But finally, I think you can't understand this story without addressing the role of corporate interests. Because, in fact, wherever we've had this expansion of rights, if you look behind who really benefits, it's not really about protecting the dead at all. And, in fact, it's corporate interests have been using the dead as a decoy to hide behind changes in the law that really inure to their benefit. So, for example, just in the copyright area, the most recent iteration of the change, it was called the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, right? In memory of Sonny Bono, who was the great entertainer, everyone might not remember that, turned congressman who then died in a ski accident, perhaps. And then so then they said, well, we got to give Sonny some longer copyright protections. I'm not sure over what. But in any event, over his music. And so that was sort of the way it's marketed. But of course, as we know, it was really Disney, Time Warner, etc., that really benefit from these rights. Similarly, in terms of this trust law, this idea, I mean, it wasn't the case that donors all of a sudden said, you know, I want to be able to control property. 100 years isn't enough for me. I want it to be, you know, 5,000 years. Really, it's been driven by banks as a way to, so that they can offer tax savings devices. These long-term trusts avoid taxes, and it's a way for them to market their jurisdiction and to bring in money into their states. And so I think that really, when you look behind, that's what's really driving these changes. As I said, I think these things really do impose real costs on us that I hope that people will become aware of, because I think that really our, if I can use the phrase, our true legacy really depends on it. All right, how was that for time?
Terrific. Thanks so much. Thanks so much.
So the floor is yours now for a conversation, and we have a softball question that's already been tossed from left field there. So do you want to?